Quit laughing.
I'm trying.
Welcome to Gola. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, an assistant professor in Italian at Dartmouth College and a certified specialist of wine.
Buonasera, Danielle. So before you tell me anything, I just want to warn you, there's a soccer match, aka football, happening in the apartment next to mine. There might be some interruptions. People are going wild over there.
I love when your neighbors interrupt our recording with their zealous fandom. And actually, it's a big week for soccer because the Super League made news three times, basically, and it's back and forth. I don't think we have enough hours of the day to talk Italian calcio. And the amazingly exciting thing that we are actually focused on this evening. And with all of that in place, let me let you tell everyone what we're doing here today, Katie.
Okay, so it's going to be a grappa-themed pod followed by a grappa happy hour. So if you're listening to this pod on the day it drops on Friday, just like make a little reminder that on Wednesday, the 28th of April at 6 p.m. Eastern, midnight Central European time, Danielle and I will be hosting a grappa-themed happy hour. That doesn't know how it's said. That's not the pronunciation. Happy hour. That's how I talk now. And we are excited because we love grappa and we want you to be excited about grappa too, but grappa is a difficult subject. What is happening with my pronunciation tonight?
Well, maybe I watched you take some of the grappa in advance of this recording, and I think that's what's happening.
I dipped into the grappa earlier. Fine. Whatever. So we're excited about this theme, and we just want you to know whether you are tuning in for the grappa sesh on Wednesday or just listening along, you don't have to actually buy grappa to enjoy what is going to be in this broadcast. We just want to talk about the culture and history, and then we're going to taste through three different grappas. You are free to purchase them. I'll let Danielle share the deets on that, but you can also just listen and enjoy.
Absolutely. As Katie says, like for all of our taste alongs, if you just want to listen, please do. We love having you here. If you have some grappa at home that isn't the grappa that we're drinking, great. Pour some, enjoy it. Talk to us virtually about it on Wednesday, April 28th. If you want to drink along with us more specifically and actually taste the grappas that we're going to be talking about, you can source them from our wonderful friend Adrian at Amphora Wine Merchants in Oak Park, as well as at other retailers, naturally. And if you have trouble finding them, you can reach out to us as always, and we will try to point you in the direction of some local suppliers who may be able to get them to your house.
That's great. So, and Oak Park, by the way, is in, I don't know if it's a suburb of Chicago, but it's Chicago adjacent, and the delivery radius is about 100 miles. So if you're in the Chicago area or some neighboring states even, you may have access to it. But also just like open your notes app, write down the producers that we're going to be talking about, and ask for your local to stock them if they don't already have them.
Absolutely. And you know, speaking of reaching out, don't forget that if you are, as many of our listeners are, in the food and beverage business and you would like to collaborate with us to find some of the excellent producers and products and bring them to the people who listen to Gola, by all means, please get in touch and we will do something just like this with other producers, other products, anything else that we think is excellent enough to put into the ears of our hungry, hungry listeners.
Exactly. This is still all very like curated Gola approved stuff, but do hit us up and you can support us so that we can make more episodes like this by becoming a patron on Patreon. That's patreon.com/GolaPod. And we've got new patrons.
We do. Oh my God. We have new patrons. And I honestly, every time I see one pop up, I'm like, can this be real? Can so many people be so generous and wonderful in this world? And it turns out it can be real, Katie. It includes Daniel McGarity, our friend Clay, who I believe is joining us from Canada. So that's our international patron, might be our first international patron. Our new patron, Leon Rossi, and a patron at the Giotto level. So that's a superstar patron, Gabe Del Virginia. There's also one other person here. I don't know. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Joanne Parla, I believe. Have you?
It's pronounced Judge.
Judge.
Right. It's my mom. Thanks, Mom. I love you deeply, and I appreciate your support. Thank you. And Joge, like a lot of listeners, has basically migrated her support from Anchor to Patreon. I'm not going to say it's the easiest thing on the planet. However, it can be done. And we would appreciate if you are an Anchor supporter, if you just like knocked your support over to Patreon. That would mean the world to us. And we really appreciate supporters and just everyone who listens and sends us messages. And we're just so overjoyed to do what we do, which is talk about awesome Italian things and put them in their cultural context. And grappa is one of the most exciting things I think to think about because it's so hard to like understand. I think it's taken me years and I can't wait to talk to you about it, Danielle.
Yeah, I have to say, Katie, I was glad that we were doing this for that reason also. I realized that sounds ridiculous. I was so glad that I was going to get drunk on grappa with you. And let me explain why. Needs no further explanation. Having drinks with your friends is the best. But I agree that grappa is a challenging subject for a lot of reasons. And it was nice to kind of dig back in, remind myself of the super long history and all of the kind of complicated sides of distillation in general and this particular distillate, and then to drink these grappas next to each other because, again, being a kind of drink that is, let's call it aggressive on the palate, it is something that we have a tendency to, or I should say that is difficult to enjoy the nuance of often. And tasting grappas next to each other is one of those times where you really get to, you know, understand the depth and the delicacy of a product that doesn't always get its kind of fair due in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think grappa is one of the most stigmatized Italian beverages precisely because many grappas present as extremely aggressive, and that's due to the kind of role and throwaway role, if you will, that grappa has in the minds not just of consumers abroad, but also in Italian distillates culture. So, you know, we have to really acknowledge that when we're going out and seeking, you know, Italian beverages, whether it's coffee or wine or Amaro or grappa, there is a distinction that can be made between the conventional and industrial products and those artisanal products of quality. There is a true discernible difference between them. And so hopefully you'll join us on this delightful path to full grappa understanding.
I love that.
Did I drink too much grappa before this? Is that maybe what's happening right now?
It strikes me as exactly the right amount. We have a very whimsical little Katie with us tonight, and I am extra delighted.
Oh, I'm super loose, not because of the grappa, but because I was in Molise for like 48 hours, and that place is amazing. But maybe we'll do an episode. Yes. I don't want to distract us from our history of grappa. So let's talk about should we talk about like what defines grappa or just like distillation? It's so hard to figure out like, where do you start with this conversation?
I think, so let's define grappa first and then we'll walk it back. So I'll give the one liner and then you can elaborate. Grappa is literally a pomace brandy. It means that it is a distillate that comes from the pomace, which is the leftovers after you've pressed the juice out of grapes and usually en route to making wine, although it's actually not obligatory that's what that must is used for after. So the pomace means skins, seeds, stems, a little bit of flesh, usually some remaining juice, obviously, and all the mess that's left behind after a pressing for wine. Now, that is then going to go through a process known as distillation. And we'll get into that in a moment, but I just want to let Katie talk a little bit about what grappa means more in terms of the place that it holds in Italy, in your meal, in your life, and, you know, how people are with it. So it's, you know, grappa is a pomace brandy. It's made in this way. Okay, great. But what is grappa? You're in Rome right now. You know, what does grappa mean in context?
Well, that's right. I'm in Rome right now. And I would say that grappa in this particular context is, it's put in the category of digestivi. So it joins limoncello and amaro, mirto and genziana as the digestive liqueur that might be offered at the end of a trattoria meal. Grappa has been produced in Lazio. There's so much wine production in Lazio and therefore a decent amount of grappa production in Lazio. But when we're talking about quality grappa and a place where grappa really holds an important cultural role and where it is kind of synonymous with the digestive culture of a region, we're more like in the Veneto, in Piemonte, we're up in the north. So we've talked about other digestivi before. I invite you to visit the Nucillo or Nocino episode or the Amaro episode, and you'll see that these digestive liqueurs, these elixirs that are consumed at the end of a meal after coffee. Footnote, we're going to talk more about how it sometimes is with coffee anyway. Those fall at the end of the meal. They're sort of like the signal that you're done eating, your coffee's been consumed, and now you are preparing your body for the physical act of digestion. In Rome, you do occasionally, and it's kind of like in the cultura dei operai, right? Like a sort of laborer culture where you might go out for a coffee in the morning and order it, caffè corretto al grappa. So coffee, an espresso, in other words, with a bit of grappa in it, something that's way more common in the north as well, but not totally unheard of here in Rome. Grappa, you know, if you visit literally any eatery or bar, aka cafe in Italy, you're going to see grappa present in the collection of bottles at a cafe, behind the bar, at a trattoria, osteria, or ristorante, like in the collection of after dinner drinks. But it's not always part of the menu that's deeply curated at any of those venues. In fact, there are only a few places in Rome where I definitely am going to like skip the Amaro, which is usually my digestive of choice, and go into the grappa category. Like at Cesare, they just have like an awesome selection, for example.
Yeah. So that's perfect, Katie. And as you were mentioning that, I'm sort of traveling in my mind to the places that I would be consuming a lot of grappa. And for me, that has usually been in the Trentino Alto Adige, where I've spent a lot of time and where there's a very strong culture of grappa, and up in the Veneto, similarly. But as you say, there are some places where you can find it in Lazio or other more southern regions. They do tend to, I think, now be aligned with almost a trendiness, which is interesting. Places that are a little more curated, a little more internationally aware, and that are sourcing grappa that is made in a careful and interesting way. So we have this sort of longer history of grappa as the traditional go-to local digestivo, and then we have a kind of newer or somewhat newer tendency for places that want to celebrate the diversity of options of after-dinner drinks, offering some really carefully made and ideally small production grappas. And that together is kind of what we have in front of us also, because we're going to drink grappa that is representing both the oldest level of production, or at least some of the oldest production, some of the most traditional, scare quotes, but in any case, following the kinds of techniques that have been used for hundreds of years, and then moving into grappa that is a little bit more of more recent. What do you even say in English? I don't know.
Dimmi tutto, ti traduco.
Della derivazione, a derivation, but I think that's not English. We're not using English that way.
We're off to a great start.
I know, it really is. And so we'll talk about how the grappa is made in a general sense, and then we'll talk about the actual grappa that you and I are drinking, and then we'll invite our listeners to chime in either at our happy hour on Wednesday or through social media whenever they have the chance, and let us know what they're drinking, and we'll talk about how that matches up or diverges from what we've experienced. So, Katie, I'm going to take this moment to go back to the kind of process, but I feel like I'm going to pour myself a little grappa because you're getting too much of a head start here, and I don't want to be not having a sip, and I'll invite all of our listeners to join me, whatever they have.
This is what I do at the beginning of my wine tastings when I'm like, I'm about to talk words about wine at you for 20 yeah. minutes, and I see you've got a bunch of wine on your table. You might want to pour yourself a glass.
Absolutely. And the reason why I am going to interrupt in advance, since our listeners obviously can be drinking anytime they feel like it, is only to say that because we're drinking grappa and because this is a high proof spirit, I do think it's worth it to take a break and mention that if you're tasting as we're talking or whenever you do taste, you should keep in mind that you're not going to want to do the swirling that you do with wine, and you're not going to want to be oxygenating in the way that you do with the lower alcoholic beverages that we've tasted together.
Okay. What glass should I be getting?
So some people will be familiar with the small tulip glass that grappa is served in if you're at a fine dining establishment. I am tasting in the most traditional way, which is with shot glasses. You'll see old school tasters are usually still using small shot glasses, thimble size if they have them. You want some room in the glass so that you can enjoy the aromatics, which will jump right out at you. And at the same time, though, you don't want to agitate. So just wanting to give everybody a heads up about that as you dip in and we get into the backstory of grappa and its deep history. So cheers, salute to everyone. I'm taking a sip.
Salute. Also, shout out to grappa for being one of the only beverages in Italy that you enjoy without food.
Absolutely. Indeed, it is designed specifically for that purpose. Just like our other digestivi, it's for typically after your meal. So whenever you're enjoying it, whether it be after your meal literally or after your meal metaphorically, in my case, it's a little early for dinner. In Katie's case, it's perfectly appropriate. I invite you to consider it on its own, contemplate it, and just don't jostle it too much, because otherwise you're only going to get heat and you're not going to get those nuances.
So when I was looking into grappa, and you'll be able to expand on this, obviously, because you know everything on the planet. So having not really thought about the origins of distillation in a minute, I kind of recalled incorrectly that distillation arrived in Italy in the 9th century with the Arabic conquest of the South. But it is, in fact, a much more ancient tradition, perhaps not grappa as we know it, but distillation as a process.
Yeah, so this is a complicated kind of subject unto itself, right? So grappa is the product of distillation. So it is sort of a history within a history that we're talking about here. So, you know, zooming out, big picture, distillation, which is the process of separating liquids into their constituent parts. Grappa then is a distillate that arrives as a result of that process being joined with a leftover product that you will not be surprised Italians had in spades, and that is vinaccia, or the leftovers from wine, from the winemaking process. So first things first, distillation, when does it become a thing in Italy? And as you mentioned, Katie, for a long time, and I think you still hear this when you go to places that just will give you kind of a spiel if you're doing like the distillery tour, that, you know, from the process of distillation comes to Italy. Usually people will say through the Crusades, as though it, you know, marched along with the Knights of the Knights Templar over to the peninsula and then from there. Like everything, and you've heard me say this a million times before, wasn't that simple. History isn't a straight line. When Italy starts distilling is not certain, and the why is also not certain, because distillation is used for lots of things, as we mentioned, not just making alcoholic beverages. We do know that people in the world have been distilling for at least around 3,000 years. We know that people have been distilling for all different kinds of reasons, and that it was certainly popular and frequently used in Central and South Asia, North Africa, and the Southern Mediterranean from around 2,000 years ago. And we know that by the late Middle Ages, people were using it to make distilled alcoholic beverages all the time, in all different kinds and different forms.
And alcoholic beverages for like medicinal use, was also perfume production in the mix?
Absolutely. So all of the above. Also alchemy, which is sort of we could call a forefather of chemistry. I want to point out also that one of the reasons that people kind of suggest that that straight line exists from Central Asia into the Mediterranean is because there's this idea that these Muslim contexts, people were using it just for perfume making or for science. Absolutely not the case. Also alcohol, people, Muslims drink and at different times for different reasons, historically speaking. The process of distillation was an important piece of alcohol consumption, alcohol culture in all of these different contexts. And people do things both because they need to and because they want to. Same as we always say with all food and beverage. Taste drives is just as determinative as need. So when it comes to that process, that's a long and ranty way of saying that we can't be exactly sure of any of it. What we know is that is the general contours. We know people were experimenting with distillation for lots of different reasons. We know that people started using it because it was a useful way to get the most out of what was left out of the kind of overall winemaking process. And we also know that people were enjoying this beverage just for the pleasure of it and not because they had to get rid of or had to make use of the leftovers from their winemaking process.
Right. So, we kind of think of it like ricotta is a way to use the byproducts of cheese production. It also is spectacular.
Correct. An excellent parallel. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm working on my analogies.
Really strong. So by the Middle Ages, people are drinking grappa for sure. They're making it and they're drinking it. Grappa, like we said, is a pomace brandy. It's in the aquavit family, if you're familiar with other iterations. And
So before we move on from that note, because I think this is an important one, the aquavit family, I'm going to do my best at a definition.
Go.
Aquavit is basically you can ferment the byproducts of wine production. You can ferment fruit and then, or honey. Can you ferment honey?
You can. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Ferment honey. And then you apply heat to that concoction, that alcoholic beverage. And then the heat causes the alcohol to evaporate if applied at the right sort of temperature, causes the alcohol to evaporate and then collect in the still. And then that condensation that's formed is channeled into another receptacle, which is your aquavit.
You got it. That's perfect. So thank you, Katie, for providing the definition of distillation that is specific to the grappa or other products that are analogous to grappa process. That's absolutely perfect and way simpler than anything that I would have been able to come up with. And now that you have that in mind, you can then walk towards the actual grappas that we're going to drink right now and that you find when you're in Italy. And so they are made in the way that you said, from what is left over, in this case, from grape wine production. And they must be made in Italy or in the ethnically Italian part of Switzerland in order to be called grappa. Grappa is a designated... Oh God, I'm back translating really poorly today.
Call it like a denomination. It denotes a location and style of production in the same way that Barolo is a delimited production zone of a Nebbiolo-based wine. Grappa is the product of distillation that we just laid out earlier. Also, I'm curious. Well, maybe not curious. Maybe this is more of like a rhetorical statement, but it seems like the grappa that might have been consumed in the Middle Ages or even in more recent times may be a lot different than what we encounter today, because steam distillation, that is heating the liquid to cause that sort of condensation and separation with steam rather than direct flame would have created probably a much different product. Like the steam distillation creates a smoother final product. I would think. I've never had the other version. Or maybe I have. Well,
yeah, that's a great point. So, you know, here's the thing where that a producer is struggling with when they attempt to make grappa, and one of the reasons for which people often have a bad experience with low quality grappa, because cooking pumice is challenging. It is likely to burn and it is likely to develop flavors that are unpleasant. It also develops methanol, which, unlike ethanol, is not just, it's not the kind of poison you can enjoy and then laugh about with a headache the next day. It's the kind of poison that actually kills you. So when you're making grappa in this process, you are running the risk of having all kinds of issues as a result of that. And as you point out, Katie, earlier iterations would have tasted different because different styles of stills were used and different materials. You'll see in the grappas that you might have in front of you or that you might explore after this, grappas making mention of being distilled, vapor distilled or steam distilled. You may notice that they indicate that they are using copper as opposed to steel or other materials that might be used now, or as opposed to still more diverse materials that might have been used in the past, and that might not have been welded together at all, or not well in any case. And so all of those things are going to affect the flavor, and especially a term you'll hear frequently around distillates, the smoothness of the beverage, of the final beverage. Yeah.
And I mean, this is a phrase that I'm more familiar with in terms of like rucka culture, because as you know, I get down with rucka, but like double and triple distillation, which also like in theory improves the smoothness of the final product.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, all of these words that are thrown around with distillation, you'll have heard them before and maybe not understand them very specifically, but you may also get distracted by them or misled by them because people who make products like this will throw the terms around arbitrarily and not necessarily even themselves either know or really be honest about what is happening as a result of that. So, you know, the question of, for example, purity or smoothness, et cetera, are questions that do have to do with the process and do have to do with the materials used, but they also have to do with the desired end, right? And the kind of product that you want. So, you know, what we've selected here, Katie, are grappas that are made well and use use consciously equipment and techniques that are being selected to create a fine product. But we're also tasting grappa that is made by families that have been making grappa for a long time in a specific way and with their final product in mind very clearly, the contours of what that beverage is going to represent and what it's going to deliver to their consumer is very clear to them. So it's not a happy coincidence that at the end you have a grappa that you're willing to drink. On the contrary, it's a very conscientious and conscious process.
Absolutely. And, you know, I just want to sort of piggyback on something that you mentioned before, because as beverage educators, we come in contact with a lot of people who are grappa skeptics, people who hire us to lead them through wine tastings and are really interested in the sort of like pleasure and history and the features of wine drinking that we all know and love. And grappa, it tends to be difficult for people because most of the grappa that is sold in supermarkets or available at liquor stores or served at restaurants in North America or wherever you happen to be, or trattorie in Italy, is not of that quality. So what you are getting is a product that is, I don't know, in some ways just like an afterthought, a way to use up trash, essentially. It's treated that way. And when something is sort of conceived with that in mind, you taste the difference. It's very, very clear. So which of the three grappas should we drink first, or am I getting ahead of us because I'm just eager?
No. I was only going to add that, you know, thank you for elaborating on that point, because that is exactly what I was trying to get to. Grappa can be perceived and treated as a way to use up garbage, and that becomes as itself just sort of, you know, slightly less stinky garbage, or rather it can be conceived as a product deserving of attention and care itself. And that's what we have here. And so I think we should absolutely get into tasting them. And I would begin. So if anybody who's listening to this after they have purchased the grappas that are available at Amphora or other grappa that is analogous to the ones that we have here, the way that you will want to approach grappa when you're tasting it together is to move from the least aromatic to the most. And if it changes, which it doesn't always, oftentimes it's about the same, from the least alcoholic to the most. And then as a kind of asterisk, if you have any grappa that has been aged in a non-neutral vessel, which is to say if it's gone into barrique or any kind of oak or other a vessel used to impart flavor, that should also be towards the end of your tasting rather than the beginning. So you want the sort of cleanest version up front, and the cleanest and coolest, which is to say least alcoholic and least touched grappa, towards the most and most alcoholic, so the hottest and the most manipulated further than that. So in our case, we have a Nardini grappa, which is their one of the most classic, easy enough to find, very easy to find in Italy, fairly easy to find in America. So if you are tasting along with us and you aren't able to buy the packs that we've put together with our friends at Amphora, you certainly can find this in your local or get it delivered almost anywhere in the United States. The Nardini Green Label here is a classic in more ways than one. It is a grappa that is produced in the most traditional way. It has been being produced at the same facility for, 250 years since the late 1700s. It is not further aromatized. It is not aged in barrique or anything else. So you'll see that it's perfectly clear. And it is produced in Bassano. Bassano is especially famous for grappa because it is thought of as perhaps the birthplace of modern grappa in Italy.
It's literally called Bassano del Grappa.
That is true. Have you been there, Katie? I have. It's a wacky
place. I actually have not, but I recently worked as a fixer on a book project, and the photographer was from there. And so I'm very tempted to go check out that person's hometown. But you know what my next trip is to Emilia Romagna for some vinegar. So that's the Bassano del Grappa visit's going to go on the back burner. But I just wanted to mention before the founder, Bortolo, not to be confused with Bartolo, it's Bortolo Nardini. Before he sort of creates his official distillery at the age of 40 in 1779, he's like a mobile grappa maker. He's got a still, I just imagine that he wanders around with a still on his backpack from place to place and then distills, you know, on demand. People are oh, I've got some freaking wine trash here. Come over and distill it for me.
He had a mobile bar, a little cart, and that pulled around his distilling equipment, and he brought it to people's homes, took their vinaccia, the remainders of their winemaking process, and would help them to distill that semi-fermented product or fully fermented, depending on what wines they were making, and distill that into grappa. This guy was a genius for more reasons than one, obviously. I am desperately sorry that I never had a mobile distiller running around my neighborhood, but the establishment of a brick and mortar, as you mentioned in 1779, then also, you know, literally becomes the foundation for a more serious culture of grappa in this place where people had obviously been working with these processes for local consumption and now making it something that can be produced in much larger quantities. And Nardini now is huge. I mean, Nardini, first of all, so I think is like 25% of the grappa market in the world, period. And Nardini is produced in large quantities. So, you know, we often limit the things that we are talking about to our golosi to items that are produced in very, very small quantities. In fact, almost so small that they can be very hard to find. With the fact that grappa can be so unapproachable, we came at this from a slightly more egalitarian and diplomatic angle and said, you know what, let's find a good grappa that is available and that people will be able to get their hands on so that, you know, we can all enjoy this Nardini together. It is objectively good. I just took a sip of it and I enjoyed it's a clean, streamlined palate. It does still have some of the kind of lovely floral qualities that you expect to have off of the grappa now. So keep in mind that this one step removed from the wine grapes means that some of those tones will be there, but then the distillation process is going to kind of wake up all kinds of things that you weren't able to get out of the grapes in a first press. And as you're drinking, I think if you really focus, you will be surprised at, first of all, the quantity of things you can taste, and second of all, the delicacy of it, because that heat can be a punch in the face at first that you don't recover from. But if you give yourself a moment and you come into it with attentive eyes and palate, I think you'd be surprised at what you find.
Yeah, you don't get like a burning heat in your throat the way that you do even with some higher alcohol wines. You do get like a tingling on your lips for sure, and you're much more elegant at naming the flavors and aromas, but I get the childhood amoxicillin, like bubblegum, tropical fruit deliciousness. And it's like, it's such a surprising flavor profile to encounter in a grappa. I actually probably have had Nardini, but it's not something that I generally like keep in my bar, but I might actually start making some cafe correcto with this because it's pretty pleasant and, again, very affordable. They sell it at my local supermarket for like 12 euros a bottle.
I will tell you that one of the notes that people will give you on things, on grappa in general, especially this one, it's jumping right out at me, is white chocolate. And that's not something that usually gets me excited. It's not a note that I'm like, can't wait to have something that tastes like, you know, cocoa butter solids and nothing else. But that chocolatiness is present here. And as I'm drinking this, it's actually reminding me of vintage champagne in a really pleasant way. That kind of toastiness, sometimes we call it biscuity, sometimes we call it cookie-like. And this is exactly that.
It's pronounced biscuit.
Is it? Sorry, I always forget. In fact, actually, it is a little bit even like an Italian biscotto because it has some of that almond. I would say it's probably more like almond flour in this case, like the actual blossom. But it's very pleasant. And, you know, speaking of a cafe corretto, a classic way that Italians will enjoy their grappa, this is perfect in it because, you know, what goes better with coffee than chocolate and nuts, right? I mean, it's a classic pairing. Yeah, right. Also amoxicillin.
Are you not getting that? Because it's 100% what I'm getting right now.
I understand where that's coming from. I wouldn't have thought amoxicillin, but I can.
I mean, I would get strep throat a lot as a kid. So I just love that bubblegum.
Yeah.
Yeah, like pink, thick bubblegum medicine. So anyway, little window into what baby Parla's life was like.
Baby Kitty.
All right. So that's a very good, affordable, like approachable grappa. So if you are a grappa skeptic, start with Nardini. Now we're going to move into something that's a little bit, much more special. It rhymes. It's Barolo. Barolo is the producer. Yeah. Barolo is the name of the wine that the pomace derives from. Therefore, Nebbiolo grape-based grappa. And because Barolo is a delimited area, you know that the grapes are cultivated, pressed, and vinified And then the pressings are delivered to Marolo. And those are all coming from a very, very small area in Piedmont.
Exactly. And the Barolo Grappa is a step in a more, precise direction in more ways than one, as you have already said for us, Katie. We have the first grappa that we're drinking that is grape specific, and you'll see that on many bottlings. It's not very hard to find, but it does mean that you are tasting something that has been made with more precision and with within a more delimited area, as you mentioned. We are working with, in this case, a bottling that, as Katie mentioned, is made with the pressings that are coming from a limited number of producers that the Marolo, it's actually, I think they're the father and son working together right now, the family working together with producers they trust to provide them with the raw material that they consider to be of the best quality. And then we're moving also into a space where we have much less production. So Marolo is not like Nardini making that kind of more widely available grappa. And so we're going to expect to taste that difference here. And I am going to pour my Marolo into a clean glass. It is immediately wildly different from what we just tasted. The aromatics on the nose are really profound and unusual. 3.5 years in neutral oak.
French oak barrique, so it's like the smaller volume one. Used to age Sicilian Marsala wine.
Exactly. And it has some of the things that we noticed in the Nardini. Definitely a chocolatiness, definitely a nuttiness. Definitely, I'm going to put it on my palate right now, but I'm expecting a creaminess to it in terms of texture. And it is indeed there. It is a grappa that is really, it's really very good, actually. I'm really enjoying it right now, having gone through some of the other bottles that we were less impressed with. This is really lovely. And the attention to detail here is immediately apparent in the glass.
Yeah, and it's super persistent, but not overpowering. I mean, this is now, I've counted like 20 seconds from when I took a sip, and you have this lingering roundness on the tongue. It's really nice.
Yeah. And as we're moving from one to the next here, we're also getting the opportunity to do what I mentioned at the top and what we've mentioned in our other tasting episodes, which is compare and contrast in the ways that you would expect, but in some ways that you might not expect. So the things that kind of jump out as I'm putting these next to each other are these textural differences, for example, not something that we necessarily think is going to be so obvious when you're basically just drinking two liquids that are that undergo the same process. This is rounder, as you mentioned, Katie. It's lusher on the palate. It's, you know, that persistence comes out as an almost velvetiness at the end. And it's also the depth here is really apparent, because in a way the Nardini almost feels like a palate cleanser against it. There's a lot happening in this Marolo glass for me. Katie, this is also from Piemonte. So we mentioned before already that this is a kind of a northern tradition. Where are the places that you look for grappa? What do you look for when you're shopping for a grappa? Are there any, you know, more specific regional tendencies that you're interested in, or anything happening right now in the grappa world?
That's a great question. So I, you know, as you know, I'm a big Amaro lover. So that's usually I'm shopping for grappa at places that have a great Amaro selection. So wine shops that are focused on also offering spirits and digestivi from small producers and quality. And Marolo has a presence at my local, which is called Le Vigneron. Le Vigneron is on Via Mameli in Trastevere, so not very far from Santa Maria in Trastevere. And I go there on the regular to buy wine and some digestivo and olive oil. I've been buying a lot of olive oil there actually lately. And I really rely on my Enotecaro di Fiducia for things like this because, you know, I wouldn't say that my natural, I don't have an intense and natural attraction. I wouldn't say I don't have an affection for grappa because I really do enjoy it. But it's like, if I'm at a trattoria and I have a choice, unless the locale has like Capovilla, some like aquavit, super small production made from heirloom prunes or cherries, like I'm probably not going to go for that over like a delicious Varnelli Amaro di Sibilla or something like that. But yeah, I treat grappa the way that I treat meat or fish or vegetables. Like I trust the person that has stocked the shelf. And so, although now we have all of these little small campioni, I think of 50 milliliter tastings of the various grappa Marolo selections, I also have some full bottles as well that I was able to get at Le Vigneron. What's your grappa strategy?
So I spent a lot of time in the northeast of Italy in particular, and so I developed a great affection for grappa over time there. And my strategy is actually to talk to the winemakers initially and find out, you know, the people who I buy wine from and I'm enjoying their wine. I ask them if they're partnering with anyone making grappa, or if there's a grappa that they like. Maybe they're not actually sending their vinaccia to anyone in particular, but if there's somebody that they like, because this is part of an ecosystem, right? And that's actually what's so cool about it. So grappa doesn't exist in isolation. It exists as either a byproduct, if we want to be ungenerous, or as a kind of a symbiotic relationship. And so I'll find out what people who have the raw material for grappa are doing with it. And if they're doing something interesting, if they're working with someone who's playing around with something new, it's great. There are a lot of people who are experimenting with distillation in Italy right now in a variety of contexts. You and I have talked about this a lot lately. It's a space that has always been lively in Italy, but I think less visible. And of late, people have been bringing their projects to a kind of larger public. And so I think a short answer to the question of what do I look for when I look for grappa, or what do I want when I buy grappa, is it's about to change, because what I'm thinking right now is that the next time I'm in Italy, I will discover a whole new class of grappa that wasn't available the last time I was there. And I'm really excited for it.
So we should definitely go to Le Vigneron, because I feel like Vittorio Graziano, who makes fantastic Lambrusco and just generally delicious sparkling wines, including one that's called Brut Sprinstein. I feel like now Le Vigneron has grappa made from his vinace in the same way. I think like Capovilla has the vinace from Massavecchia. And if I'm not mistaken, Cadenocci, maybe they're making Nocino and not grappa. Anyway, we'll update everyone when we actually go to the shop together. But you're right. There is this really important relationship between the distiller and the winemaker if the final product is meant to be quality. And, you know, for the Marolo grappa made with the vinaccia from Barolo, you can expect the vinaccia to come from, a litany of quality producers. Giuseppe Rinaldi, Paolo Scavino, Prunotto, Germano Ettore, Aldo Conterno, actually another Conterno, Giacomo.
Yeah.
And I mean, Pio Cesare, the list goes on. So
if you drink Barolo at all, you know all of those names very well. So yeah. you'll be familiar. Yeah.
I mean, also all of those producers make a lot of wine. So they have a lot of vinace.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, speaking of names you will have heard of, if you drink grappa at all and you like it, our last grappa is the absolute biggest name in the game when it comes to quality. We're talking about Poli. People will, if you have any interest in grappa, you have seen the bottles. They have particularly beautiful bottlings. They have really exquisite packaging. They have been making grappa for a very long time, not quite as long as Nardini, but back to the 19th century. And they are a large producer, but a quality producer and a very conscientious producer in terms of the relationship between the history of the product and the product that they're making right now. We are drinking the Poli last because we are specifically drinking the Poli Aromatica, and it means that it is using the grapes that are highly aromatic to begin with. In this case, we have a Traminer, which is the Italian version of Gewürztraminer.
Yeah, I mean, also a lot of the aromatic grapes. So just to sort of describe what aromatic grapes are. It's been a long time since my SOM course and that I've like refreshed this definition, but it feels like the aromatic grapes are the ones that don't just have like an incredibly floral and fruity bouquet, but ones in which the aromatic compounds translate directly from the grape to the final product. So a lot of the aromas that you perceive in wines are these esters and like aromatic compounds that are the byproduct of fermentation, whereas aromatic grapes produce wines that have a sort of one-to-one translation of those aromas.
Yes, that's a really important point, Katie. Thank you. And something that's worth saying no matter what the subject of our podcast is, because this is an idea that I think is hard to understand when you're learning about wine. Most people spend a lot of time tasting before they kind of put those two pieces together. So the Poli is expectedly aromatic. I mean, it's just a hard left in comparison to what we were just drinking before in terms of the fact that it is immediately notably fruity, although I guess you were enjoying the amoxicillin flavors of Nardini.
I did like that. What I like about this is I get like green tea with honey in it, like right off the bat.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say honeyed is the word that comes to mind for me for sure. It has that kind of depth and richness also of the fruit flavors.
Okay, so we are really both really enjoying the Poli aromatic grappa. Super round, very gentle, so much honey, and for me, like iced green tea vibes.
Very much so. Yeah, I feel like it's a kind of combination of that. It's funny because there is tea for sure, and it's almost the kind of soft tannins that you would get off of that. So there's like a connection that's very specific there in terms of the astringent, a good kind of astringency that's there for me. And that balances beautifully against those honeyed notes and I think, yeah, like a green tea with honey is an excellent kind of one-stop shopping note, if you want to give it that. I think I'm also definitely getting some of the citrus fruit that I would expect that maybe is being suggested to me by Gewürztraminer as a grape also, but that feels present here for me, like a grapefruit peel kind of thing.
Mm. Let me just, I got to try it again.
I'm just drink some more. There's only one way to be confident.
Yeah, you're right. Uh-huh. Exactly.
So, Katie, we enjoyed this grappa tremendously. I expectedly enjoyed drinking it with you. We hope everybody listening has a chance to enjoy these or other grappas while they're listening to us and after as well. What other last things might you impart to our golosi as they embark on their grappa journey now that we have embarked together?
I mean, I would say if you are in the Chicago area, definitely get the grappa box from Amphora. If not, go to your local or maybe seek out specialty spirit store that you have never been to before. Ask them what type of quality grappa they stock and then sort of follow the same tasting ritual that we did. And, you know, treat this like a buona bevanda di meditazione, like contemplate it, think about it. Reflect on what's happening like on your palate and how it makes you feel. And it's a different way to sort of get in touch with your senses and really enjoy this really special beverage. And, you know, we tasted the widely available and borderline mass produced Nardini Grappa Bianca. We went then to Provincia di Cuneo in Piemonte for Grappa Barolo's, Grappa from Barolo grapes. And then we went up to, is Poli in Alto Adige?
It is specifically in Schiavon, right outside of Bassano da Grappa. It's technically the Veneto, but it is right at the edge there.
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful. Well, check out those if you can. I also want to give a special shout out to Grappa from the Nonino family distillery and my favorite Italian distillates generally in life come from Capovilla, especially the fruit aquavits. Those are really wonderful, but they do a line of grappas that are really interesting. So look for those and others and hit us in the DMs with what you think or comment on our post. We want to know what your grappa feelings are.
Absolutely. You know where to find us. I'm at Dr. Caligari's Cabinet. Katie's at Katie Parla. And we're going to be doing a live happy hour with grappa on Wednesday, April 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's midnight in Europe and 3 p.m. in California. You know, come join us if you can. Bring grappa, don't bring grappa. Listen to this episode with or without grappa. Let us know what it made you think of. Let us know what your experience has been in the past with grappa and what comes up as a result of this. Like Katie said, ask your local wine shop or spirits provider to pick up some different grappas for you so that you can do the experimentation when you have a chance. And, you know, bring to grappa the same thing that we suggest you bring to all of your food and beverage experience, which is an open mind and some enthusiasm. And I think you'll really enjoy it. The end of your meal is a great time to pull out the grappa, but you could also do it in the middle of the afternoon like I am right now. Salute.
Here's to
everyone.
That.
Absolutely. We will see you on the next episode of Gola. Arrivederci e salute.
Arrivederci, ciao.